And this is Connections, a chance to meet your North Shore neighbors. News, politics, left, center, right, newsmakers, people, issues, features. Connections on MSO News Sports.
Hello and welcome to Connections. I'm Rick Moore, along with our producer and engineer, Bill Proposky, the voice of the North Shore, of course, Bill Newell. And this program we try to put up here every Thursday on MSO News Sports. And mostly it's trying to get a hold of North Shore newsmakers and connections with them and with others. Today we will be talking with Heather Atwood, who was long known around here in the last couple of years for her her food blog, Food for Thought. But now she is on quite an endeavor that's going to take place over the next year with a friend of hers. So we'll listen into Heather's account of where she was last week. And we talked with Heather on the road in New Jersey last week. Plus, she's got numbers 14 and 13 in our best top 50 dishes countdown. Also, we'll be checking in with Dr. Brian Blake. There we go. Dr. Blake is the new superintendent of schools in Ipswich, and we had a chance to talk with him. And Bill and I will be chatting with Jonathan Blodgett, who is the Essex District Attorney. And, of course, also on our website, you should be finding right there on our main page a terrific interview that we had with Ernie Tremblay yesterday of the Sylvan Street Grill. And hope you'll check in on that. Very informative and just a terrific man to talk with, and just a great place there, too. Of course, he's got three restaurants in the area, and please listen to that interview when you get a chance. First, we're going to take a very short break, and then we're going to check in with our North Shore Today News, and then we'll get to our interviews. And again, this is Connections on MSO News Sports. Stay with us.
People come in, take a seat, you're really in for a treat at Sylvan Street. A great place to eat and drink and meet with family and friends at Sylvan Street. We'll treat you right, day or night, satisfy your appetite. Eat, drink, and chill at the Sylvan Street Grill.
Catch a game with friends, meet for lunch, cocktails after work, or a romantic dinner for two. Whatever your plan to do it at Sylvan Street Grill in Peabody and Salisbury. See you at Sylvan Street.
Eat, drink, and chill at the Sylvan Street Grill.
This is North Shore Today for Thursday, August 17, 2017. Ariana McNeil writes in today's Salem News, a rally for love is planned for the Beverly Common on Saturday, a response to the deadly events in Charlottesville, Virginia. 15-year-old Eliza Michaels, who will be a sophomore at Beverly High School in the fall, decided to organize the rally as a way for the community to come together. The rally also offers participants a way to counter a planned free speech rally set for the same day in Boston. Concern of hatred and bigotry have surrounded the controversial event, as widely reported by multiple news services. The 15-year-old Michaels is quoted as saying, "I keep seeing more awful tragedies happening, and I kept saying, why is this happening in the world?" A counter-protester was killed, many more injured, when a car was driven into the crowd in Virginia last Saturday during a rally that included white supremacist groups. In the wake of that incident, Michaels felt motivated to do something within her own community. She didn't want to take the news of the violence in Virginia and do nothing. More on this story in today's Salem News, story written by Ariana McNeil. Well, homicides in the city of Lynn are now the second highest on record. Bill Newell has that story.
Rick, Thomas Grillo writes on today's front page of the Daily Item out of Lynn, Pedro Carrillo was sitting outside an apartment building on Kerwin Circle when a man came up and shot him in the head as his mother looked on in horror. The next night, a man was stabbed to death on Union Street at a rooming house where police found the victim bleeding from the chest in an apartment. The pair of killings on the first weekend of August were the city's 10th and 11th homicides of the year. That's the most since 1994, when there were 14 homicides, according to the Lynn Police Department. Records from the FBI confirm this has been the second bloodiest year in the city since they began keeping records in 1960. Quote, "It's very distressing. Even the loss of one life is unacceptable," said Lynn Police Chief Michael McGeary. "I've lived in Lynn for 55 years. My wife, children, and parents live here, and I take this personally. It's certainly not the way I wanted to start my tenure as chief." Essex County Sheriff and former Lynn Police Chief Kevin Coppinger said, The spike in the murder rate in the 1990s stemmed from the crack cocaine epidemic. Quote, many of the murders that year were drug-related, with a war being played out on the streets. McGeary said that the accessibility of guns, the blatant disregard for human life, and the perpetrators who have no fear of consequences have contributed to the high rate. There is much more on this story in today's edition of the Daily Item of Lynn. For North Shore Today, MSO News Sports, I'm Bill Newell. Rick?
All righty, Bill. Thank you, sir. Ethan Foreman writes in today's Salem News, Boxford's small, hilly, enclosed landfill will give the town a big boost when it comes to producing electricity and cutting greenhouse gases in the decades to come. That's thanks to a new 1-megawatt solar field that was built on the capped landfill over the winter and is expected to start producing power on Monday. The project, worth several million dollars, according to the developer, consists of approximately 2,700 panels, but it did not spring up overnight. It's been a little over 7 years since the town's sustainability committee first considered the project. More on the story in today's Salem News, story written by Ethan Foreman. Mary Marcos writes in today's Gloucester Times, two women and their dog, stung multiple times by a swarm of bees, were safely escorted out of the Cathedral Pines Conservation Area in Manchester by the Sea on Wednesday after a 24-minute search by rescuers. A call for an ambulance for somebody stung by bees with a potential to go into anaphylactic shock in the area of Cathedral Pines off Upper School Street launched the search by Manchester by the Sea and Essex police and firefighters around 12:25 p.m. Rescuers found the women and their pet at 12:49 p.m., a 24-minute response time. The two women were walking towards the rescue team when found. More on this story in today's Gloucester Times, story written by Mary Marcos. This is North Shore Today on MSO News Sports.
MSO NewsSports.com is known for connecting North Shore sports fans with local sports newsmakers. Features on teams and players. Exclusive video interviews following the big games. Live event coverage such as high school football, basketball, hockey, and baseball. Live video coverage of the Gloucester Fiesta. MSO also connects you to the area news leaders, mayors, state representatives, state senators, town administrators, city and town elected officials, business leaders, and more. Entertainment features. Follow us on Twitter or Facebook at MSO News Sports. Email us at msonewsports@gmail.com. Leave a voice message anytime, 978-325-3638. Stay connected to your North Shore neighbors by simply clicking on msonewsports.com.
Back at the Pleasant Street Tea Company with MSO News Sports, I'm Rick Moore with one of the two moms from the midterm podcast, back from New Jersey, Heather Atwood. And Heather, I'm glad to see you back safe and sound.
Thank you, Rick. Yeah, traveling was relatively easy before the weekend, I should say.
Okay, so let's discuss. You have a brand new project along with your business partner, and tell me a little bit about that once again. Give me a little background.
Right, so I've sort of morphed since we started these interviews, and I've always been I haven't always been a mom, but for 22 years I've been a mom, and now I'm one of the two moms. And this is a project created by my colleague. I'm delighted to be shoulder to shoulder with her, and we are traveling the country, going to swing districts around the country, congressional districts that are, you know, where the races are going to be tight in the 2018 midterms. And we are telling the story of these districts. We're interviewing candidates. We're interviewing citizens. We're learning the histories of these places. We're learning the cultures of these places. And we're basically telling the story of each of these districts so that when the rest of the country begins to hear about, oh, you know, Michigan 11 is sort of a contested race, and you get some blurb on the news, you think, well, what does that mean? You could come to our podcast and hear the whole story and understand the story of what the people are dealing with in these districts, what their concerns are, how the candidates are responding to them, and you'll understand better what's going on.
Now, you have a business partner in this who is well-versed in politics, I understand?
Yes. She grew up in a very political family. Her mother had been married to a U.S. senator, actually, and that senator died in a plane crash. The mother remarried, and so Nisi's father is is from the second marriage, and they were still very political. He was actually, he was an attorney, but he had been in World War II and has a really, really amazing story that I won't go into here about World War II. But they were, you know, she grew up in Washington, in Virginia, and she was basically steeped in that culture and the culture of Congress, really, when she was growing up. So she really knows her stuff. I'm the voice of, Niecy, can you please explain NAFTA to me? You know, how do you say things like that?
Or else, moderator, all right.
Right, exactly, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Well, we need that, and we need, obviously, both. It's going to be fun to listen to, and I know that we talked to you on Connections last week from New Jersey. And
Jersey 11.
Yeah, you were telling us about the people you were interviewing, and give us a review on that now.
Okay, it's a really interesting race. I think all of these races are interesting. But the congressman from New Jersey's 11th congressional district, the incumbent, has been in that seat for 11 terms. His father was in that seat for 11 terms before him. It's an old family. There's this who's who of American families. And this guy, Rodney Frelinghuysen, his family's name is right up there with the Adams, the Kennedys, the Bushes. They are a really serious political family. And this guy has held his seat just very comfortably. Nobody asked any questions because he was their solid congressman. Very much a Republican, but kind of a Republican who was progressive. You know, he was an environmentalist. He was he basically supported Planned Parenthood until recently. And in the past 5 to 6 years, he's been voting very, very differently.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you got a call.
Yeah, well, that's my emergency alarm.
Is it an emergency?
No. Just so I can hear it.
Okay. So so this guy has sort of stunned his voters by voting 100% down the line with Trump. Mm-hmm. And these are it's a very educated community. They're very sophisticated. They are not pleased with the way he's voting. Not only that, they haven't seen him for about 3 years. He's refused to talk to anyone in the district for at least 3 years. So they have these really wonderful rallies every single Friday afternoon since last November. Citizens show up at his office. It's called Fridays Without Frelinghuysen. He's not there. And they, you know, basically just have a very quiet protest. And they, by tens, they go into his office and ask questions.
Your representative government at work.
Exactly. I'm talking 400 people show up at these things.
Yep.
This is not small.
Okay.
You know, and they have only missed one because of the weather since last November.
Now, am I correct in that there is a Republican challenger lining up against him?
There is a really charming guy. By the way, there's food in our podcast, and I posted Martin Hewitt's omelet recipe on Facebook yesterday.
Okay.
Martin Hewitt is running as a Republican to the left, as a progressive, to Rodney Frelinghuysen. You know, so the other thing to be said about Rodney Frelinghuysen is he is the chairman of the House Appropriations Committee, the most powerful position in the House of Representatives. So it's going to be kind of hard to fight him. But it's really interesting. He has all that power, and yet his constituents are really not happy.
Okay, so you and Niecy interviewed the Democrat candidates, I presume?
Yep, there are two Democrats. They're both really, really strong. The first immigrant Democrat we interviewed is a woman named Mikey Sherrill. She went to the Naval Academy. She was a helicopter pilot, had 10 years of active duty in Europe and Iraq flying helicopters. She was the part of a team of that was the American liaison to Russia when she was in the Navy. After that, she went to Georgetown Law, got a job at the U.S. Attorney's Office in New Jersey, was an assistant U.S. attorney. So she has a lot of creds. She is one really, and the mother of four children. So she's pretty interesting.
Okay, so we don't want to give too much away because you have a podcast. Now explain how that is working or will work.
Yes, I will. Podcasts to some people are, you know, one of those things where you say, huh, what's that mean? And there are other people who say, oh, my God, I love podcasts. My whole life is, you know, is driven by them now, or people drive and listen to podcasts.
Mm-hmm.
Podcasts are freestanding audio. You know, you can, it's downloadable. It's, they're podcasts about every subject you can imagine in the world. So you can start to listen to one, and then if you arrive at your destination and you have to get out of the car, you just put it, you know, turn it off, and you listen to the rest when you get back in the car. So it's that kind of a a piece of media, which, and it will be on our website. Our website is going up today, but we won't have this first podcast ready really for another couple of weeks because we are still beginning to understand how editing works and how engineering works, and we're working with a producer. So we're not quite there yet. So we're ready to launch, I'd say, in a couple of weeks.
Now, the website will be up. What's the name of the website, or how do we find that?
It is called The Mid Pod, and truly, it's supposed to go up today. I think if you were to do just Google The Mid Pod, you should be able to go to that website. And on the website, there's a short description of what we're doing, and it says coming soon.
Okay.
But so there's not much more than that right now.
Right. Is it midpod.com or dot whatever?
It must be .com. Okay, well, we're we'll still working with the woman, and she, it hadn't actually gone up this morning.
Right.
And so it should be www.themidpod.com.
This sounds really very interesting and very unique because you have, you know, what the big media, the big boys, will pick certain things and do certain interviews, but there's not a lot of depth on it. And the other thing is, like, when someone does do something depth on a, some depth in-depth reporting, generally it goes into either 60 Minutes or 2020 or something like that, that not... it might not grab the attention of as many people as a podcast will, and you guys are doing it in such a way to me that you know it's easily accessible by all these devices and so on, and people can, as you just said, you can listen walking on the sidewalk or whatever. But you're doing something I think that I don't know, it's just kind of unique.
Well, I think so, and I have to also say that we have a hashtag. The hashtag is the two moms.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of from that point of view. Mm-hmm. You know, Nisi, as I said, is really well steeped in politics and policy. But we're still kind of going at it as we are two moms who want to understand what's going on here. And we also want to understand the district and understand the people as opposed to just, you know, what does this candidate say and what does that candidate say? I mean, for instance, in New Jersey, there's the wonderful story of George Washington. This district, Morristown, New Jersey, is where Washington spent that horrific winter, you know, of 1779 and 1780, when he thought it was all over. And he had no money. He didn't, his troops weren't clothed. He had 13,000 troops in that Jockey Hollow in Morristown, New Jersey, and it was the worst winter of the century. In fact, somebody said it was the worst winter America has ever seen. I don't know if they experienced what we had a couple of years ago. But so there's that cultural piece, and they say that Jockey Hollow is where America survived. So we felt it was kind of poignant to talk about our first podcast, and with this country in almost a constitutional crisis,
I think it's almost.
No.
editorially speaking.
Right.
I was just thinking, Heather, the power, the potential power of what you're doing, because let's just start with this New Jersey town again. People, let's say people in Salem or Beverly listen to this, and they make a connection. They say, I really want to know about Dinglehauser or whatever his name is, Feeling Housing. Okay.
Yeah.
I really want to know about the other candidates, or I backed this person because of what I heard. And because of the Internet, because of Facebook and LinkedIn and Twitter and Instagram and everything else, people on the North Shore who are not in that district can actually make connections with people in New Jersey.
Exactly.
And have an influence.
Exactly, because who those districts send to Washington in 2018 is going to matter to all of us. You know, they will be making decisions for the entire country.
Okay.
So we need to care about who these districts send to Washington, you know.
And it sounds to me like a painless way for people to learn about this stuff rather than sitting down and immersing and studying it. This, you guys, well, you make it entertaining, and so it will be easy to listen to. But, you know, right now, just sitting here, I want to hear those interviews. I can't wait.
Oh, well, that's really nice. I don't think I've even mentioned the food element, which is another reason I am present.
Yeah.
Okay, so we are going to be holding a potluck dinner in each of these districts. The potluck, we probably aren't going to do audio from the potlucks because the audio is so tricky, and
pictures.
We're not...
You've got to take pictures.
Yeah, right, exactly. And we really want people to feel comfortable sitting around a table, a variety of voices, and we will have recipes because everyone will be bringing a potluck dish.
Okay.
So I'm going to sort of choose the recipe I love the most from each potluck dinner, and we'll talk about that.
And there'll be a new book coming.
Let's see.
All right. Well, speaking of food, where are we in the top 20?
Okay, we are at 15 and 14, all right? We're getting down there, all right? Mm-hmm. So 15, you ready for 15?
I'm always ready.
Okay. Kahlua pig.
Kahlua?
Pig. Pork. Pig.
Okay.
So I know,
the
but
Kahlua
you
got my attention.
Yeah, right. You would probably there's no Kahlua in it. That's what's really interesting. It has nothing to do with Kahlua. It's from Hawaii. It's a traditional luau dish. Mm-hmm. It's the smoked pig. It's done in a sand pit on a beach in Hawaii, which sounds just lovely anyway, right? And it's just this salty, smoky, delicious pig.
I'm watering my
also, head. Banana leaves are involved. So they're banana leaves in the pit. I'm not quite sure how that works, but if you do it at home, you wrap your pork butt in banana leaves, and you can do it in a crock pot.
Okay, that sounds most interesting. It really does. And it's funny, as an aside, my wife and I honeymooned on Maui, and the least fun we had, and I say that in a relative way, was the luau, because it seems so manufactured and so... I don't know what the right word is, but that was the least amount of fun we had. And, everything was sort of prepackaged and pre-cooked.
Right. And I think there's a lot of Kahlua pig done that way, from what I understand, from what I read. They said commercially it's the only place you can find it in the country, and yet that word commercial made me go,
The luau didn't seem spontaneous or homey at all to us, and that's not to knock anybody, because it was a wonderful time over there. Okay, so 15 is Kahlua pig, now down to 14.
Donuts.
Now we're talking. We're finally talking. It's been a long time since we had chips. Now we're down to donuts.
No, so we've, 13 should be a cup of coffee, but I don't think it is. I don't think we have coffee out there. So, yeah, donuts, that's it. You know, number 14 on the list of the best foods in the world, of the 50 best foods in the world.
And we don't even have to qualify or specify.
Right, that's it, right?
I love it.
Although
I love it.
I can tell you my favorite donut.
Okay.
I think I may have mentioned it before, actually, because it was on the other Cape. Brothers Brew in Rockport, Massachusetts. They make their own donuts. They've been making their own donuts for probably three generations. Mm-hmm. Their plain donut with a cup of black coffee is quintessential America.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what's weird is I'm not a donut fan anymore. I used to be, and whatever donut, it wasn't a donut I didn't like. But now the only donut that really that I look forward to now and I think about is in the fall when you go to an apple orchard, maybe the one out in Ipswich, and you have the cider donuts that they have there with cider.
Yeah, those are, and they have to be warm.
Oh,
you know,
and
just,
greasy like crazy.
Exactly, right. That's the only way to have those things. Yeah, no, they are really good.
Okay, well, thank you. And what's now what's next in terms of the two mid-pod. Moms and the mid-pod?
Our next trip is to Michigan, Michigan's 11th Congressional District. We are going there after I drop my daughter off in Ann Arbor, Michigan, for college. So August 28th through September 1st, we will be in Michigan's 11th Congressional District, and there's a great story there.
Okay.
I'll save it.
All right. Yeah,
okay.
Absolutely. All right, and you got more to talk about on food, too. We'll save that, but we'll hopefully get together again next week.
Yes.
That is Heather Atwood of the MidPod. This is MSONewsSports.com.
Hi, folks. This is Gerard Moynihan of Moynihan Lumber. If you're thinking of replacing the windows in your home, you should look at the Anderson Woodwright double-hung insert window, which comes with rich wood interiors in oak, pine, or maple. Quite simply, Anderson is the most trusted window in America. That's why we've been selling them for 57 years. Please see the Anderson Woodwright windows on display at any of our three locations in North Reading, Beverly, and Plaistow, New Hampshire, or at MoynihanLumber.com.
Moynihan Lumber, we measure up.
This is Connections on MSONewsSports.com.
With MSO News Sports, I'm Rick Moore, and at the office of Ipswich School Superintendent Dr. Brian Blake. And Dr. Blake, I want to say welcome to the North Shore.
Well, thank you very much. I'm looking forward to a long tenure here in Ipswich. It's exciting to be part of the Ipswich community coming down from New Hampshire.
Give me a little background as to what you've done, maybe what your formal education was, high school and beyond, and then how you ended up where you are here.
Sure. I graduated from high school in New Jersey, a Catholic high school, St. Joe's High School in Metuchen, New Jersey.
Well, where's that? Where's Metuchen?
Metuchen, New Jersey is just a small community in central New Jersey,
okay.
Not too far from the Jersey Shore. Did my undergrad work at Penn State University, my master's degree at New York University in psychology, advanced graduate degree from Plymouth State, and my doctorate from Argosy University in Florida.
Ooh. So, and what's the doctorate in?
My doctorate is in educational leadership.
Okay. Got to be careful now, knowing you have a psychology degree. I'm going to be real careful here. Okay, so how did you tell me about your experience in education?
So I started off in residential treatment centers, Spaulding Youth Center, many moons ago. And from there, I went into the public school system as a school psychologist, worked for a number of years as a school psychologist, and then became a special ed administrator. From special ed administrator, went to assistant superintendent and then superintendency, and this is now my 16th year as a superintendent.
Okay. In your experience as a superintendent, I found that obviously, we get men and women from all different backgrounds, and nobody can be an expert in everything. You know, some are K to five, some are 8 to 12, and across the spectrum. So, how do you keep up with the literature, and how do you decide as to maybe I don't know who's going to help you in these endeavors? How'd you do that in the past?
Well, having a background in school psychology and working with at all different grade levels, I have a pretty broad spectrum of knowledge in terms of working with students at all ages, mm-hmm. as well as adult learners. Coming here to Ipswich, you know, certainly in this community and being so new to this entire area of the state and Massachusetts in general, I'm going to have to rely on the people around me that have been here for a number of years. There's a lot of history, a lot of long-standing administrators that I'm able to rely on to help me learn what's going on here in our community.
Realistically, it takes a little bit of time to get acclimated and to listen. But on the other hand, you stepped into a hornet's nest right away. So what's going on the last several weeks?
Well, entry into a new superintendency is always a tumultuous time anyway, because there's, you know, superintendents change districts for different reasons, this changeover was no different. The superintendent before me retired, and actually he went to New Hampshire. Coming in, I had an entry plan, and so the last couple of weeks I've been spending a lot of time interviewing different people. I've individually met with each school committee member, each one of my members of the leadership team, some of the people here in the central office, and I have a lot more to do. The entry plan itself takes a couple of months to complete by the time I do all the interviews and then distill all the information and then prepare to share that back with the school committee. So I've been spending a lot of time doing that over the last couple of weeks, as well as trying to organize things and read contracts and understand the ins and outs of the district. And then we have this thing called the building project going on
that we're trying to look at.
So I've been digging in on that as well.
Well, and from what I understand, there are people who have dug in as well. But in the community, it sounds like, and I know that you're new to the community, but talking with the school committee chair, Sarah Player, the other day, people are very invested in the community, both kids, both people who have kids in the school system and kids who don't, people who don't. So this thing, how much of a role do you see yourself playing in this? Because this is, yeah, it's a political thing, it's a budget thing. How does that involve the superintendent? And what I'm talking about, of course, for those who don't know, is a need for a new school or schools, plural, in Ipswich, and I guess the site location has been the big question mark so far. But how does the superintendent play into that?
Well, it's interesting. It's a very good question. You know, as I was going through the hiring process and was selected for the position, I sort of watched from afar in that all of the decisions were supposed to have been made prior to July 1. So I thought everything was going to be decided and I was going to walk in and have a clear indication of what we needed to do. That didn't happen. And so we're in the throes of deciding all that now. The school committee has decided on a one school project at the Doyon site, so we're moving forward to complete the feasibility study on that project. The superintendent is the educational leader of the district, and so my role is to be an integral part of all of those conversations and facilitate the project moving forward, as well as facilitate the bringing the community together. Mm-hmm. There's been a lot of division in the community between folks who would like to see two smaller schools maintained versus one school, and then the whole notion of the location of that school. So there's a big rift in the community right now that we've got to heal moving forward.
I've heard that before in other places as well, and I appreciate that, of course. What do you think? I guess I'd ask a general question about philosophy, about maybe what are some of the issues that you see as a superintendent coming into the Ipswich community. I mean, education today, certainly with devices and with technology and so on, is it's just growing so many ways exponentially, and I'm not sure they're all in a positive direction. But what do you see coming in, and what are some of the maybe the ideas or philosophies or the overall view you have of things?
Well, I think today information is readily available, and so we've got to teach our students how to think critically about information, how to work collaboratively. We've been doing some work here in the district with Successful Habits of Mind and teaching them the critical skills that they need. As you suggested, with the technology today, information is readily available. And so it becomes a little bit less about, certainly the content is important, but we've got to teach them, in addition to the content, how to think and understand and evaluate and assess information for its worth. You know, there's a lot of, let's say, fake news out there. And alternative facts, I think they call
them.
And so we've got to be working with our students to help them understand where to gather accurate information.
Now, I'm going to ask you a loaded question, and you can just say, I don't want to answer that, or tell me to go pound sand. But and we didn't talk about this in our pregame warm-up. But I've never asked this of a superintendent before, and I'd like to know what the real answer is. What's the most important role of a teacher?
To me, the most important role of a teacher is to help students understand how to learn. We're not teaching content. We're teaching kids, and we've got to we've got to help them to be able to become lifelong learners and think and act critically.
And also, teachers have to be involved in the overall health of a student. And I'm sure that again, part of the literature, you must have been inundated with information that comes down from various sources. And things change so much. I was hearing this morning from the district attorney about trauma in students that I had never even heard of before all my years of education. That this trauma that may not manifest itself until a kid's maybe a senior in high school that he experienced 12 years before. So. I can't imagine the overall burden that you're under right now with all this stuff.
Well, as a school psychologist, I've always known that trauma is there. You know, many of our students are presenting with difficulty learning that has nothing to do with their ability to learn, but rather a hindrance because of something that's happened in their life. And so I think it's wonderful that it's become a frontline issue for folks now, but that trauma and dealing with social-emotional issues of students has always been there.
And we're doing something about it now, presumably. Okay, yes is the answer to that. Good. Well, finally, Dr. Blake, I'm just wondering, school is opening soon, and so maybe what's on your mind now coming up in the next few weeks that maybe you'd like to pass along? Okay, I can see the wheels turning.
Well, I think, you know, as a new superintendent, certainly, you know, I need to spend a good chunk of my time listening, understanding the community, understanding their needs, understanding my staff and where they've been and the journey that they're on, and developing a solid understanding of the Ipswich school system, so that I can form a clear vision of where I think we need to head next. And that'll take some time, and it will come out of all of the entry interviews that I've been doing. Certainly I've had some great conversations with my school committee and understanding where they're coming from, and my administrative team. We have a leadership team retreat next week where I think we'll come together and begin gelling as a team, and then be able to jump into the deep end of the pool, as it were, with school starting right after the holiday.
I think you already have started that. Thank you so much. That's Dr. Brian Blake, who is the superintendent of schools in Ipswich with MSO News Sports. I'm Rick Moore.
Sunday brunch at the Gloucester House. The brunch includes Gloucester House baked haddock, grilled beef tips, fruit-filled crepes, chicken, potatoes, and much, much more. Sundays from 10 to 2, $20 for adults, $12 for children. The Gloucester House, on the water at 63 Roger Street in Gloucester. Owner Lenny Linquata.
This is the freshest seafood you can get, from our boats to your plate.
Gloria Food Store is still Beverly's number one deli, and no matter what New England weather is thrown at us, Gloria is open. With fresh bread delivered from Sunray Bakery every morning, Gloria can provide party platters, calzones, hot trays, cold trays, salad trays, and finger sandwiches for whatever you have planned. Call in your order at 978-922-3613, stop in at 268 Rantoul Street, or visit GloriaFoodStore.com.
This is Connections on MSONewsSports.com.
This is MSO News Sports. I'm Bill Newell, along with Rick Moore and Essex County District Attorney Jonathan Blodgett. And District Attorney Blodgett, welcome, and it's great to have you with us.
Thank you, guys. I'm glad to be here.
First of all, congratulations, I guess, on being president-elect for the National District Attorneys Association. Tell us about that, maybe about the organization, and then about being president-elect.
Sure. Well, I'm really, truly humbled and honored that my peers elected me to be president of a great organization. The National District Attorneys Association is the voice for America's prosecutors. And we have 5,000 members, and 2,600 of those members are elected district attorneys from all over the country. Our primary purpose is to train young prosecutors to help make them better attorneys and better prosecutors in court. But we're also on the front edge or the front lines of criminal justice reform. We lobby Congress as our society changes, evolves, and we make changes in the criminal justice system. So it's a great honor, and it'll be a great challenge, and I'm looking forward to it.
Do you have anything specific that you're kind of looking at, or a direction or interest that maybe you didn't just mention there?
Sure. I mean, there's a couple of things that I'd like to get involved and put my mark on. One is the John R. Justice Act, something Congress passed a number of years ago, which would help provide student loan relief for young prosecutors and public defenders. I think it's so important that in this day and age, when we want good people involved in the criminal justice system, that we help them get a break in terms of their the wages are very low, as people, I think, understand and realize, is for assistant district attorneys, and student loan relief for these kids who come out into the world after they go through law school and take the bar exam with six-figure debt is a crushing burden. And we're trying to get the John R. Justice Act now funded, which would give kids up to $10,000 a year for 6 years, or an aggregate of $60,000 in loan relief to help them with respect to the low pay they have, so we can get and guarantee good people in the criminal justice system.
In the in that context, are there you see budget problems all over the country? Are there young people coming in? Is this is this organization, is across the country, is it sustained? Do we have like sometimes you see a teacher shortage or that kind of thing? How's that working?
It's the biggest obstacle we have and challenge, and it's my biggest lament. A good day for me is when someone's sitting in your chair right now and I get to hire them, an assistant district attorney, and they're enthusiastic and they want to do good things and they want to make a positive impact and change. And then the worst day is when they come back and sit in that same seat and tell me they have to leave because they can't afford to stay, that after a number of years, maybe they're with us 4 or 5 years and they're making in the mid-40s and they can't afford to get a house or a condo, get a car, get married, and because they're so saddled with debt from law school, and they love the job, but they just can't afford to stay here. And this often happens when they're just getting really good at what they do. They know how to try a case, how to value a case. So it's a hard day. So it really goes in the extremes, and we have a real issue keeping and retaining lawyers. I've got very dedicated people who have been able to make a career out of it, particularly in Superior Court, but retaining people that we'd want in district court is a daunting challenge.
You're involved in, you know, working with the Essex District Attorney's drug diversion program. We hear so much about the opioid problem, other drugs, of course, on the forefront as well on that. So tell me about this program. What's the purpose of the program, and how is it working?
So the drug diversion program is modeled after our juvenile diversion and youthful diversion programs that we have in the office that have been, I think, quite successful, giving kids a second chance. Kids make mistakes. We understand that. So we had expanded our juvenile diversion program for juveniles. We created a youthful diversion for kids 17 to, it had been like 21. We've expanded it out even further than that. So that if they commit a criminal offense, but it doesn't involve an act of violence, and they have little or no record, we want to give them a chance to not go through the criminal justice system, but go through diversion. And diversion is work. It involves many components. The most important component is this accountability. But they have to do certain things in order to complete their diversion obligations. And then what brought them to our attention ends up, frankly, going away. Sometimes restitution is involved. So it's a program. Hundreds of kids have gone through it over the years. In 2007, I created the drug diversion program, modeled after our other diversion programs, received a little bit of state grant money, and our goal was to take people who found themselves in either the throes of addiction or just starting to head down that fateful road and give them an opportunity not to go through the criminal justice system, but to get actual medical help, both in mental health services and also for their addiction. It's a program that I strongly believe in. We've been able to expand it. We first started it in two of our eight district courts. We have eight district courts in Essex County. Now we have it in all eight district courts. We started it with people. We were targeting people between 18 and 25. Now we have no age limit. And the whole purpose here is to get these people the ability to get help and help themselves. It's managed through Bridgewell. They were our successful healthcare provider. We work extremely well with them. They do the intakes when someone's coming to court, and we have both pre-arraignment, which is important, and post-arraignment. So sometimes we're able to offer it, if it's applicable, before people even step foot in the courtroom, and we tell them if you complete the program as set up by the clinicians at Bridgewell, upon successful completion, the matter that brought you here will not go forward, and you won't have a criminal record. And we're hoping to get people who understand that they're really sort of at the precipice. It's worked, I think, extremely well. We've expanded it, like I said. I think it helps the community, so it keeps people out of the system and they're not going through that revolving door. But I'm a firm believer in it. And, again, working with Bridgewell, we work with school departments, the police departments, it really makes a difference in helping somebody get that second chance that everybody deserves.
I was going to ask you about the health aspect of it, the health care aspect of it, but it's such a complex issue involving, economics, involving education, involving health care when people go into the hospital and so on. So it sounds to me that this kind of program really needs to get out there so people can understand it. But also, you mentioned police, local school resource officers, they would be educated in this as well?
Well, the police departments understand that we have this as an option, and they'll bring it to our attention, someone they believe would be worthy of consideration. I think all the police departments and the police chiefs work with us quite well in that regard. School departments, we have a great relationship with school departments and superintendents. who can sometimes identify some child who's having an issue. So we do everything we can to provide whatever resources possible to keep these people out of the criminal justice system. One of the great difficulties or obstacles is that we find that a great percentage of people that we're trying to help with the disease of addiction have co-occurring mental health disorders. So the intakes become very complicated. Because we're lawyers. We first got this grant, they gave it to us, and we said, look, we're going to give it back to you to fine-tune it. We will absolutely want to create this program and make it succeed, but as attorneys, we don't have the ability to devise a plan of treatment. It has to be the clinicians, and they do that. And everybody who goes through the program has an individualized treatment plan in terms of what they have to have done. And then upon successful completion, we're working on aftercare, vocational care, housing opportunities. So it's really a holistic approach, but more importantly, when the people are done with the program, and it gets extended out for a period of time. If insurance is available, we use it. If not, you're not going to be out of the program if you don't have insurance. But at the end of the successful completion, we stay with you. And I say we, the clinicians, and our joint effort to make sure that you have, hopefully, the tools you need to succeed and be contributing citizens.
We are talking with Essex County District Attorney Jonathan Blodgett. I'm Bill Newell along with Rick Moore here on MSO News Sports. And there's also, you've been doing some training out of your office on animal cruelty with local law enforcement. So tell us more about that and the kind of the prosecutorial case history of animal cruelty, say, in Essex County.
So the impetus for this is we were very fortunate to receive a grant from the Stanton Foundation to fund two prosecutors in terms of the investigation and prosecution of animal cruelty cases. The case for us sort of started in this county a number of years ago when we had a successful appeal to the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court about an animal who was being abused over in Lynn. And without getting too technical for the listeners, we were able to convince the court that, like human beings, if someone's in obvious distress and it's visible, that situation would allow police to take action. So I've sort of boiled it down in very basic terms. But that was sort of a landmark case in Massachusetts that caught the attention of some national organizations. Animal cruelty is an important priority for us. People who see animals being abused are very motivated normally to reach out to us, to talk to the police departments, and we think it's a very, very worthy cause, and we're very happy that we're able to have a unit that would prosecute these cases for some extreme and really horrific cases of animals being abused.
It speaks to, when I talk to different people sometimes, about the knowledge base that a street patrolman really needs to have, in other words, to do his or her job, that it's much more complex than it might appear. With all these different issues you mentioned, the drug issues, animal cruelty issues, those are just two, but it's very complex, and education has got to be huge.
Well, education is a critical component, and the criminal and what we do is evolving all the time in terms of how we handle matters. I mean, the ultimate goal is to help people make good decisions. The ultimate goal is to serve the public as best we can. And the animal cruelty part is important, but we've been doing trainings for the last number of years on autism, helping police departments understand when they get a call and arrive at a scene, if somebody's autistic, how to handle that, something that wasn't done a number of years ago. So you name the subject matter, if it's something that we can do or something we can work with our partners in law enforcement to better protect the public and serve the people, our citizens, we'll do it. And the autism training is something that sort of just one aspect that I think a lot of people aren't aware of, but we do that to help our law enforcement partners better understand what they have to deal with. So you name the topic. If it's something that's happening and we can be involved in doing a good job, we want to do that.
We didn't talk about this in the pregame warm-up, but just a follow-up how do you keep up with the literature? Because it seems to me that all the things that you're mentioning now require research, probably regulations and so on, but new stuff comes down the pike every day from above, doesn't it?
That's a very good question, and it's true. But I am extremely blessed, and I say this all the time when I speak to different people. I have a great staff who will bring things to my attention help me in terms of setting priorities with this office, work to make sure that if there's an issue that we can get in front of before it becomes a real firestorm. That's what we want to do. So, I mean, in this day and age of unlimited information and getting, you know, inundated with that, I have to rely upon my staff to bring the things that are important to my attention, and they do that exceedingly well.
I want to back up, maybe get the big picture look here back for your office and how you relate to different communities and partners in Essex County. I know you've touched on some of this already, but just for our listeners, what's, you know, your countywide, you know, communities are broken up, Salem, Beverly, Lynn, Danvers, whatever, but tell us about the overall interaction between your office or and among the cities and towns.
Sure. So there's almost 800,000 people in Essex County. We have 34 cities and towns, and we're rich in diversity in terms of the makeup of the towns. We have, you know, seacoast towns. We have urban centers, and you know, you have to make sure that you meld your services and your perspective to serve all of that. But I mean, we're so rich in geography and history and heritage in this county that it just makes it you know, a joy. But I've always understood, even before I became district attorney, that if you don't have community partnerships, you're not going to be successful. So I make it a real point to sit down with the superintendents every year. I usually do it in October and say, okay, the school's been in for a month. Give me a peek over the fence. What's happening? What do I have to be aware of? What's going on? And they tell me that. So I work with the superintendents to try to understand that, to find out what I can do to be helpful. We do we do two big breakfasts every year. We do a policymakers breakfast, which we invite police chiefs, superintendents, first responders, resource officers, judges, and try to pick a topic that we think would be important and then expand on that. And I do a school safety conference. So this next month, we're doing our annual policymakers breakfast. It's our 15th breakfast, and our topic is childhood trauma, because what I've learned in the last couple of years through staff and some great partnerships is that so many kids suffer from undiagnosed childhood trauma, which becomes problematic as they get older, and it manifests itself many times in things that happen in the schools, and sometimes those are misdiagnosed. It's trying to understand what's going on with the child, how do you best deal with it, how do you help that child, and it's not just something that may be thought of as being maybe ADHD, but something that that child has seen or witnessed or experienced at a young age that never was dealt with, and now as that child becomes older and gets into teenage years or adulthood, there's going to be manifestations of that. So I thought that was going to be a great topic. We're bringing in some great speakers from California, and then we're going to have a workshop right after that for the schools to be trained in two diagnostic tools that we're going to provide for the schools to help with kids once they come into the system and there's a realization that something is wrong.
I have so many other questions, but talking about the makeup of Essex County, and I'm wondering what the chain of command is for local police departments. For example, up in Salisbury, Chief Fowler up there was telling me that being a border town, fireworks are legal in New Hampshire, right across the street, but they're not legal in Salisbury, and pot ostensibly is legal in Salisbury and not legal in New Hampshire. So, and what you just talked about with school shutdowns and school safety and things like that. So what's the hierarchy if a police department has a question or needs to know about policy through the district attorney's office?
Well, I mean, we field questions all the time from different departments. And like the communities they serve, police departments vary in size. And I always encourage the chiefs. The chiefs meet once a month. I try to make the monthly meeting, the Essex County Chiefs, if there's an issue, to talk to us, speak to us, so that we can hopefully resolve it before it becomes an issue. Mm-hmm. So we have constant communication with almost all of our police departments. You mentioned it really kind of a sticky situation with, you know, border towns always have issues with the other states, because every state is their own governmental entity, and every state has, I think, things that make their state unique. So when there's issues like that, that ilk, then we try to work it out. I mean, and if you communicate well, normally, hopefully, you can stop the fire before it starts.
One last topic. In the news this past weekend, obviously, the events in Charlottesville, Virginia came front and center.
There's talk about a possible kind of get together in Boston. I'm sure that's going to happen this weekend or not. But hate crimes or those kinds of things, tell us about your office's role in that, say, over the years.
So, and I don't want to jinx myself, but we've been fairly fortunate in Essex County. We have people in this office who are very seasoned and good attorneys and can differentiate between something that's free speech and a hate crime, because hate crimes often involve in some action as well as the spoken word. But having said that, it's been my experience that most of the situations that cause community concern that could be considered to be hateful speech or speech that's offensive to the community involves, in a normal case, a young person. And young people make mistakes, and young people do things sometimes out of lack of maturity or impulse. So we do everything we can to work with organizations like the ADL and school departments to provide services to these kids so they understand the consequences of their actions. They understand the import and the hurt that it causes a community, and get those kids into diversion or some services so that they understand that and it ends. So we're very cognizant and sensitive to those issues, and we handle those as best we can.
Great talking with you. I don't know if there's anything else you want to share with us, but as a closing comment, but it's been great having a chance to talk with you.
Yeah, it's just the only thing I say this to your partner, Mr. Moore. I haven't done a pregame warm-up in a long time, so it's good to bring me back.
Well, there's some mental stretching going on before this all began, I think. All right, District Attorney Jonathan Blodgett with us. I'm Bill Newell along with Rick Moore on MSO News Sports.
Alrighty then, that filled up that hour. I hope you got something out of these interviews. We had great fun talking with Heather Atwood of the Midterm Podcast, and that will be starting very soon, as will their website with more information on it. Dr. Brian Blake, Superintendent of Ipswich Public Schools, and of course, you just heard Bill with Jonathan Blodgett, the Essex District Attorney. And of course, don't forget to check out our website from time to time if you are interested in stuff that's up there. We have lots of information. And again, I want to point you to our most recent interview with Ernie Trombley of the Sylvan Street Grill. Of course, Sylvan Street Grills, I should say, as he's got the Sylvan Street Grill in Peabody, the Sylvan Street Grill in Salisbury, and the Bradford Tavern in Raleigh. So check that out. That's up there right now. We also have, of course, our daily newscast, North Shore Today, is posted. Endicott College football. Bill stopped over there for practice yesterday. You can check out some photos and the interview with Coach Kevin DeWall, and, of course, all other great stuff. And tomorrow it's Trending Now with Josh Arnold right here on MSO Radio Channel A. That will be at 11 o'clock. Do I have that right? Yeah, 11 o'clock. And, of course, every Monday we have North Shore Sports. It's a live programming, but lots of other stuff. And we will be posting our football schedule, our high school broadcast, our high school football broadcast schedule coming up here very, very soon. If you have anything you'd like to mention, you can go ahead and email me at MSO, email Bill and me at msonewsports@gmail.com, msonewsports@gmail.com. Questions, comments, complaints, suggestions, whatever, send them along, msonewsports@gmail.com. So that will take care of this edition. I appreciate your listening in, and tell people about us, will you? This is MSO News Sports. I'm Rick Moore. Our producer and engineer is Bill Proposky, and, of course, the voice of the North Shore is Bill Newell. Thanks for joining us. See you later. Bye-bye.